Matt Segundo here, and I'm a little upset. After all, I have to introduce someone who uses an alter ego. I distrust such people, don't you? I mean, how can we place credibility on anything they say? Take my name, for example. Matt Segundo. That's my name. I've never gone by anything else. And yet people insist that I'm invented, fabricated. This can't be a real name or a real person, that I'm some guy in Canada. I've never been to Canada. I can barely find that silly little country on a map, and I'm sure it's a very overrated place. Well, I'm not going to take this. I don't care what any of you think. Cast any aspersion on my character that you like. Send me hate mail, particularly postcards, because they're of great use when I dry heave. But I want to assure you that I pay my taxes just like any good citizen. Matt Segundo's the name. Introductions are the game. Get used to it. Because of this, I feel compelled to declare this week's guest an utterly worthless human being, even though our young roving correspondent apparently met him at a nice bar called Obzamzam. Daniel Handler, if that is indeed your real name, you are a scoundrel, a useless blackguard of the First Order, a few cards short of a full deck, a man whose trust is as smelly as his must, and what's worse, you're a lot richer than me.
So I am here with Daniel Handler, author of Adverbs, as well as some children's books I think some people may have heard about, as well as Watch Your Mouth and The Basic Eight. Daniel, how are you doing? We're here at Obzamzam.
I am fine, thank you. I've never heard it pronounced Zamzam.
Zamzam?
I always say Zamzam, but I don't know.
Really? I don't know if there was...
It just occurred to me that if only Bruno were here, because he would have an opinion, and if you disagreed with the opinion, you would be thrown out of the bar.
Bruno, by the way, yes, he was the much lamented bartender who you had to have very strict deportment here to order your various martinis.
If you grew up in San Francisco, as I did, he was a peculiar kind of challenge because you wanted to go drink in a bar and not get carded,
yeah. And
he didn't card you, but he might throw you out for ordering the wrong drink. And basically, he would throw you out for ordering anything that was slightly flowery.
Yeah.
And of course, when you're not old enough to drink, that's all you want. So I have a very clear memory of coming here, I don't know, when I was 17, and that a friend of mine ordered a zombie.
Wow.
You know, because he'd read about it in some book.
Yeah.
So he thought maybe that was elegant. And of course, that's sort of a spring break drink, I guess. I don't even know what's in it, but it's definitely not something you order to a minimalist opinionated bartender.
Well, he also,
so we were thrown out.
He also kicked you people out if you sat at the wrong table or if you like conducted yourself in a weird way. He had this whole full-blown code that you had to deconstruct.
He was a harsh mistress, yeah. Bruno. Now he's passed on and the new owner is a perfectly pleasant guy.
Yeah.
He allowed me to sit here for many hours writing a short story, actually. My only alcohol induced writing that's worth mentioning.
is the short story in this book or?
No, the short story is was in a McSweeney's anthology.
Oh, okay.
And then actually became one of the best mystery stories 2005. Woohoo!
Woohoo!
And it takes place in a bar, so I went down to the bar to write it.
Do you often write stories or fiction in the locales that you actually set them your stories in? Or?
No. But it was at a time when I had a really young baby. Now I have a toddler, but at the time there was a really young baby, and it was hard to be in the same building as the young baby. So I utilized more public places, and that's actually, I ended up writing a lot of adverbs in places like that. And I think it's more the other way. It's not that I had a location in mind and went to it. It was more that I was in a location, and so now I have a novel in which people are hanging out in bars and cafes for a great deal of time because that's what I was doing.
Gotcha. Well, that was one of my questions, sort of, in the sense that your writing is often of a sort of Kafka, Murakami sort of fantasy mixed with personal experience, and I was wondering for you, what comes first, the personal experience or sort of a mad kind of idea of invention? Or?
Well, both, I guess. I mean, the fantasy is part of my personal experience.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I should admit that. Maybe that makes me sound more psychotic than I actually am.
You've seen a ghost of your, you know, former high school flame.
No, but I think about it a lot. And I knew a woman who died, and shortly before she died, we were talking about old flames, and she mentioned that an old flame of hers from years gone by had also died, and then there was this really awkward pause, and she began to giggle because everyone in the room was thinking, oh, you'll be reunited at last in the afterlife, even though that wasn't what she meant. And I began to think about the afterlife, and if you would be reunited with someone you loved, but what if they didn't love you back? I mean, yeah. You know, there's a select group of scenarios where that would be great, reunited in the afterlife. It would be perfect because they love you, but what about if you're rewarded by being reunited with your lover and then maybe your lover's being simultaneously punished by being reunited with you? So that's an example that it's not personal experience. I've never been to the afterlife, but but it was part of my own personal experience to think about it.
Well, let's talk about how these stories, which you refer to as a novel, came about. Well, first of all, let's get the nomenclature right. Are these short stories interconnected? Are these a novel? Why do you call this a third novel?
Well, I think it's a novel. I guess just because when I was working on it, I didn't know what it was. So it wasn't as if I was working on disparate short stories, and then I thought, oh, what the heck, we'll just call it a novel. I was working on a novel that was wandering all over the place, that didn't have a usual narrative arc, and
I can't imagine that.
I know. It was very strange for me, and also not really how I work. Normally, I do a lot of research, have a big outline, get all your plans set, and then write the novel more or less according to plan. And this time, I just kept sneaking away between Snicket books and writing these stories. I had no idea where they were going, and then sometimes I would just say, well, I like that idea, and I think I'll just use it again. I'll write another thing, and so I thought I was writing different drafts of something. I had no idea what it was, and it was really sort of terrifying. And I had 1,000 pages.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it's just a lot. For not knowing what you're doing, that's a lot. If you don't know what you're doing with 5 pages, you can forgive yourself, but 1,000 pages, really, you gotta know. Yeah. And so I just began to imagine a structure that was for the novel that that felt maybe pointillist or at least multifaceted. And then I read a few novels that I remembered being set that way, The Book of Laughter and Forgetting, and this novel by Dale Peck called The Law of Enclosures, which I feel that no one has read but me. And a few other novels that this novel by Nicholas Montserrat that I really loved called Depends What You Mean by Love. And so I began to feel confident that it was a novel. And it was actually only when the publisher was talking about it that they said, you know, we could call this a collection of short stories. And that seemed so utterly wrong to me that I nixed it.
Gotcha. Well, do you find that the short story format allows you to experiment more, or that it allows you to kind of try? I mean, you do try a lot of different things. There are different types of love explored. You've got group love. You've got the story where the postman singles on this hapless gentleman who everyone's students falls in love with. You've got the aforementioned ghost story that we were talking about. I mean, how did the sort of the love theme kind of come to be? How did the adverbs theme come to be? And what was it about these little sort of interconnected tales that, you know, allowed you to, you know, kind of explore these particular things?
Well, it was just that love was interesting to me, and that's not normally how it works. Normally I get interested in some story, you know, girl kills a boy. Then I began to think, where is the girl and what boy was killed and how does that work? And this time I just kept trying different versions. It was almost like Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, building the same mountain over and over again, but not actually having any grip on what the mountain was. And then it turned out they were all love stories, and I began to think more about love and read more about love, and so it became clear that the link between all of the people was actually just thematic rather than literal. And so it went from there. So then I had this 1,000-page sort of the Clash Sandinista type Prince Sign of the Times kind of mess of structure, and then I had to pound away at it until it became more manageable and something I hope a little more elegant, if still slightly Sandinista-esque.
Now I should note that there is an Adam and a Joe among the characters. And part of me was thinking that Adam State had not, in fact, died in the Basic Eight, and it somehow managed to, you know, find a way, a new kind of existence through in this book. And there's also the Joe who is a little bit similar to Joseph. Maybe you can, you know, shed some light on these potential parallels, or do you just like the character names Adam and Joe?
Or maybe they're just a few kinds of men, really.
Yeah.
That man might more be like it. No, there's actually an explicit connection between adverbs and the Basic Eight, which I'm waiting for someone to pick up on, which is not the connection that you were guessing. I have real trouble naming characters, and I recently at Herbst Theater was having this. I did this thing with Jonathan Lethem, and he was talking about. He has binders full of character names with no characters to go with them, and I was thinking that I ought to just buy some from him,
yeah.
You know, for a case of bourbon or something, because I can never figure out what to name anyone. And because of the structure of the novel, I wanted all the names to be pretty plain, and so I just took some names that I thought were the plainest. Actually, Joe was stolen from a line in... Sandra Bernhardt's Without You I'm Nothing, where she's describing an ex-lover of hers, and she says his name was Joe, just to give you a visual image. And I just thought that was really funny, because you have no visual image with the word Joe, so it seemed like a good name to go with.
Now, there's one thing I wanted to ask you, and that is, in this book it's not as much the case, but with you, you tend to write fiction. And I've been meaning to ask you this. It's like all of your characters seem to be younger than you are. And it's as you've gotten older, the sort of expansive range of their ages is, you know, in Watch Your Mouth, you've got post-college life. With this, you're starting to see people who are in their 20s and their early 30s, with the exception of Gladys, the older actress and everything. I was wondering, do you set this kind of limitation willingly on yourself? Do you feel that you can't really write about older people, or?
Well, to a certain extent, I'm working on a novel now that's actually has a bunch of quite old people in it, and it's a challenge to try to imagine how one looks back on life. And there's such awful portrayals of older people in so much literature that's sort of that rosy hue of flashback that's so disgusting in so many novels, and often in so many otherwise splendid novels.
What about Gilead?
We'll just be this.
Yeah.
And so so there's something of a challenge about that. But also, I think youth is just full of drama.
Yeah.
I mean, it's inherently there's inherent dramatic potential in just anyone's life story at 25. I think that is not necessarily happening at 55. Mm-hmm. You know, they're young. They're making dumb choices. They're sleeping with the wrong people. You know, that's six novels right there.
Yeah.
And so I think there's just something, for me, inherently attractive about that mindset. And
you're drawn more, I suppose, to a stage in life where people are forming their decision as opposed to regretting them.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, the best literature about middle-aged people is mostly sort of miserable, it seems to me. I mean, it's mostly crumbling marriages and, you know, oh, I lost my job and everything's spiraling downhill. And, a lot of that literature is very beautiful, but there's just something inherent in it. It's almost, I mean, I wrote a novel that I threw away before The Basic Eight, and it was all about a murder, and it was... And that just seemed the easiest way to get a plot going. You kill somebody, by the time you get rid of the body and explain why the person was killed, you're done. And so I think with youth, there's something about that. By the time you explain how in the world they got to living in such a crappy apartment and such a weird job and why they're going out with someone who's entirely unsuitable, you're already at the 200-page mark. And so there's something inherently exciting about that to me.
You know, you're more likely to channel your exuberance this way than through, you know. Then again, you could also write an exuberant novel about, you know, regretting decisions or misery. I mean, there is a certain dark comic streak throughout.
I guess so. A friend of mine is a novelist, has a sci-fi urge that he keeps letting go unscratched. And I'm trying to convince him to write a novel about the end of the world, but have it be a really happy novel. But that's all I've given him, and so he can't make hay with it whatsoever. But, you know, there's this whole genre of apocalyptic fiction, including in David Mitchell.
Yeah.
That's all mourning. And I just think there must be a way. I mean, if you're 50 years past the end of the world and you're still living on, you're probably not constantly in mourning for the end of the world. You're probably just living your life. And so it seems to me there's a potential there for an exciting novel, but not probably one that I could write.
Now, most of your work, interestingly, is written in first person. There are some third-person digressions in this. But I wanted to ask you about this. Even the Lemony Snicket, you have a narrator here. What is it about sort of having a narrative voice like that that, you know, causes you to sort of, do you find first person easier for you to access? Do you find that it's a better channel for your exuberance as opposed to third person? Or?
I find most objective narrators, an objective third person tone to be unconvincing. And so it's almost as if every book is really in first person, except sometimes the author or narrator never quite speaks up. And so I think that's it. I thought adverbs would all be in third person, and then the first person kept cropping up. So I think more it's just impossible to reach the objectivity that some people think is automatic if you just switch everything to the third person.
Why not embrace subjectivity of third person? One of the great sort of subject. Well, then again, you're dealing with a narrator.
Well, I think adverbs, all the third-person stuff is pretty subjective. And the novel that I'm working on now is third-person, but subjective. So there's something to that. But oftentimes there's a distance of third-person that feels a little phony. And I think all my favorite novels are first-person, including some that are really distant first-person. I mean, people always forget that Madame Bovary is narrated by a first-person plural, for instance.
Yeah.
And that's such a beautiful novel. And if you opened it to the middle of it, you would say, oh, look, it's in third-person, and it has this objective, distant tone, but it doesn't at all. It has a character there that's telling the story, and that's pretty fascinating.
Well, even, like, Les Miserables has these passages devoted to, like, you know, these little mini essays there, throughout midway through the book, you know, very so often. So it's like, it's almost as if you can't get away with it. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, where was I going with this? I think I was going more in terms of like for example, the opera section in Watch Your Mouth could have easily been written in third person and maintained that subjective tone. So why tell it from a first person? Is this kind of
I guess so, but it's Joseph in Watch Your Mouth who thinks of the whole thing as an opera. It's he who is having what is either an elaborate fantasy or a freak out based on an elaborate reality that is going on, and so that book is so clearly in his head. I mean, he's so oversexed and so suspicious of everything around him that to get out of his head seemed wrong. I mean, storytelling is pretty much the revelation of information in a certain order, and there's something that rings so hollow often to me when it's a supposedly objective situation and then the author just sort of refuses to tell you stuff because it makes the story more interesting. And I just think, you know, if you're omniscient, you know everything, so just tell me what's going on. There's something that gets phony about it very quickly for me.
I wanted to kind of talk about a few little ticks that I've observed in your work. First off, you have this weird, interesting sort of dialogue where you have a word or a phrase italicized and a character repeating this. What's the motivation for this? It's like, you know, it's generally like someone calling a name or uttering a phrase. I've noticed this in all three of these books where, you know, it's like, you know, Jimmy, 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 and they're like this Jimmy sentence, Jimmy, or something like that, you know. It's not only that, it draws attention to itself because it's also italicized too, you know.
Well, I'm just interested in the way that people talk, and It's always tricky when you're writing dialogue because you want it to be realistic, and yet the way people actually talk is fragmentary and strange, and if you ever wrote down dialogue the way people actually talked, it wouldn't make any sense, and people would think you were insane, and it would read like a Gertrude Stein prose poem. And I guess I'm just interested in the way that phrases get bounced around and people pick up on them. I mean, in the simplest of conversations, someone will say something and someone will grab a phrase and sort of make hay with it. I mean, almost the way a psychiatrist will say, you know, you were saying it freaks you out when you enter your home. Well, what freaks you out? You know, using the exact same language to force someone to explain themselves. And I actually think that happens in just about all conversations that you overhear or that you participate in.
So this is an effort on your part to sort of chart dialogue or conversation more accurately in your books, then?
I guess so. Just about everything that is recited by all of the characters in Adverbs was overheard.
Uh-huh.
And whether that means it's realistic, because it's all been rearranged, or not, I guess is up for debate. But it's actually the way people talk about themselves and talk when they're in relationships. And that was another reason why so much of it was written in public places, is because that's where people go to have out their relationship troubles. And I would hear all this priceless dialogue, and so much of it felt very stylized, you know, felt David Mamet-y or Haruki Murakami-esque or something. All these strange turns of phrases and very artificial, I mean, literally laden with artifice of style of speaking that you don't think of yourself speaking that way. But if you're, say, chewing over a romantic relationship, you're going to end up with the self-help cliches and the pop song lyrics and all of this detritus that washes upon us and makes us think about the world.
Well, even in the Basic Eight, though, you had this whole italicized repeating the word or the phrase. I guess, what did you do for the Basic Eight? I mean, maybe you can describe how you overhear dialogue and then transpose it or reshape it when you turn it into a piece of fiction.
I listened into teenagers when I could find them. I read a lot of really crappy psychology books about dealing with adolescence.
That explains that.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like, who's that author of The Secret Garden?
Oh,
who writes about sex?
Yeah.
Nancy Friday.
Yeah.
And, you know, to the delight of teenage boys everywhere, she compiles people's sexual fantasies and then has real tacky psychological commentary in between. And there are all these books about adolescence that lets the adolescent speak and then puts a framework on that experience that has nothing to do with at all what is coming out of the mouth of the adolescent in question. And that seemed exactly the perfect experience of adolescence. Mm-hmm. That it's this wild, uncontrolled thing and that everyone is peering at it. Your peers are peering at it, to use a really bad pun, and trying to make meaning of it. So a lot of the rhythm of the dialogue came from that.
Well, bad puns are also a specialty, and I, by the way, happen to like bad puns myself, and I've used them all the time. But your particular puns, there's more of a kind of, I guess, interesting conduit. Basically, with your... What will happen in reading one of your books is that people will either misinterpret or reinterpret a word or a phrase. Maybe you could describe how this kind of comes into play. Is this related to your sort of overhearing conversation, or is this just what describe?
I guess so. I'm just a sort of a literal thinker in a lot of ways, and so. Yeah, it's almost a psychological affliction, I think. When someone says, this is the worst party that I've ever been to, I always think, really? Wow, that is a bold statement.
Yeah.
And even though I know they're exaggerating, there's something about the superlative that really grabs me. In fact, just speaking of it being a psychological affliction, I just had this strange experience where I read a collection of short stories, The Unsettling by Peter Rock, which is really, really good. Peter Rock is sort of my new favorite, and I've been talking about him and had occasion to meet him, and I'm really crazy about his writing. And I decided it was the best collection of short stories I'd ever read. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, before I'm going to think of that for sure, I better reread several short story collections that I thought were very, very strong. So I reread a William Trevor one and a Laurie Moore one and a Alice Munro one. And you know, I just began to reread these short story collections to see if I really meant that Peter Rock's short story collection was the best I'd ever read. I mean, that's a psychotic thing to do. There's no reason to do that. It wasn't as if I was about to say it on national television and yeah. I wanted to make sure it was accurate. It was just in my head that it was the best. And there was something about taking the word best that freaked me out so much that I had to reread it. And it wasn't until I was halfway through Open Secrets by Alice Munro and trying to decide whether I should go back to Birds of America and reread certain portions of it that I just reread in order to compare it to Open Secrets and then to go back to Peter Rock. But I thought to myself, this is not a way one needs to behave to make sure that the word best in one's head actually resonates. But I think there's something so slippery about language that as a panic reaction, I grasp the literal meaning of so much of what comes out of people's mouths, and that's not what anyone means. 90% of the time is the literal definition of the word.
I don't know if it's a psychological affliction, because it's like almost how we live in a technology trap, and we sort of take that for granted here in the city. If like one thing goes wrong, then basically it's complete chaos.
Yeah.
Just like we take for granted the fact that we are capable of using language in a way that, you know, where we can utter these kinds of, you know, ultimate pronouncements upon, like, you know, the world around us. So what you are doing, I suppose, is a bit of a service in the sense that, you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's not a psychological affliction at all. It's a service.
It's a sociological experiment.
That's right.
Yes.
People should be grateful for how I feel about words.
Yeah. Damn it.
Thank you.
No, I mean, but it's a very, I think, I mean, I kind of think similarly to you in terms of, you know, how that's pretty much where humor comes from, really. It's all about that kind of misassociation or the attribution of a meaning to a word that goes off, that you're able to find, like, sort of a joke. I mean, is this probably where your sense of humor is kind of drawn from?
I would think so, yes. Yes. It's something, I will say that it's something that really annoys me in literary criticism.
Yeah.
When you're passing judgment on other people's words, it seems that you should choose your words very carefully.
Yeah.
And yet, when you open any newspaper book section or literary journal or something, somebody will say, this is the best novel in 10 years. And I think, you need to think about that really hard. And it has nothing to do with the book in question.
Yeah.
It may be a really terrific book, but it sort of upsets me that someone would say, you know, this is the most exciting debut since Catcher in the Rye or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that a debut?
I didn't.
Well, anyway.
I thought Nine Stories. Did Nine Stories come out
maybe,
before?
Maybe. I don't know.
I don't know.
I'm not such a Salinger freak, actually, that I would know. But when someone chooses some arbitrary, well-established debut or novel or something and says, this is the best one since this, and I think you need to read them all in order to have that. Or negatively, right? When Dale Peck says Rick Moody is the worst writer of his generation.
Yeah.
I think, have you read every writer of Rick Moody's generation? I mean, that would take a lifetime. And what about the unpublished ones? What about all these people? You know, are you really prepared to say, to lay down that complaint? I mean, surely there are a whole bunch of hacky, you know, non-fiction writers for teen magazines. They've got to be worse.
So maybe he could get let off the hook if he said, you know, Rick Moody is one of the worst writers of our generation.
Or more properly, I don't like this book very much, which is pretty much what he meant.
Yeah.
So that kind of literary criticism where you're calling you're calling attention to someone's words sloppily with your own words.
Yeah.
Really bugs me.
What do you think?
You see it in political conversations, too. Someone says, on the basis of this statement on Meet the Press that a member of this administration said that turned out not to be true, I'm ready to say that this is the most corrupt politician in 35 years. And I think, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, not that I'm a fan of the current administration by any means, but that But that kind of exaggeration is precisely the kind of exaggeration that people shouldn't do on Meet the Press.
Sure. Well, I mean, what do you think accounts for this phenomenon in literary criticism and even everyday world to sort of lay down the gauntlet, so to speak, and declare things? I mean, is this the only way to grab people's attention? You have to grab people by the lapels and say, this is the worst thing I've ever experienced?
Oh, probably. I don't know. When I just came back from this tour for Adverbs, and people, at two of the events, people asked me about the blurbs on the back of my book and said that perhaps they were both of them were overly enthusiastic. Such a charming question. And I always replied, well, if they said, I don't know, it's a good book, try it.
Yeah.
That just isn't, that's not a selling point, I guess.
Yeah.
And if you're reviewing books for a publication, you're, at least when I review books for a publication, I'm self-conscious about the fact that it's going to be combed through for a possible laudatory quote. And so once you know that's going to happen, you can't help but tailor your language accordingly. And so you're likely to exaggerate, I guess.
Well, how many blurbs do you think have managed to, because of this attention to detail, how many blurbs have you managed to score?
I don't know. I haven't tested it. Although I reviewed The Plot Against America for our own San Francisco Chronicle, and then a sentence of mine was edited in such a way that a superlative, I can't remember what it was, but it said something like Philip Roth's most powerful novel or something. Yeah. It didn't say best. But it said something superlative, and I haven't read all of Philip Roth's novels, so actually I would have no idea. And that's precisely the kind of statement that I never would make, but that was edited in such a way that it ended up being that way.
The magic of ellipses.
Yeah, and it always irritated me because I felt that someone could come up to me and say, what about Operation Shylock? And then I would have to say, well, I haven't read that one, I don't know. Maybe it's good.
He's an imposter, that man. Oh yeah, actually, here's a fun little question. I just want to get the name right, but you had an interview with Ron Hogan in 2000, and you remarked that one of your editors, Susan Rich, pointed out that your work is fueled by rage. Is this still the case?
Is yes, rage Susan Rich is still my editor.
Well, yeah.
did I really say that she really said that? That's strange.
Well, yeah, that's what happened to Beatrice. And it was such an extraordinary sort of statement that it was the kind of rage that you had put into your adult fiction that encouraged you to go and to do the Lemony Snicket books. That was the sort of the idea here. And
well, I will say that I'm really inspired. I'm more inspired by books that miss the mark than I am by books that I think are really wonderful. Mm-hmm. If I read a book and I think it's terrific, I sort of sulk for a couple of days professionally.
Yeah.
And not out of jealousy, or maybe not just out of jealousy, but because I just want to read it. Yeah. There's nothing that I want to go in and do better.
Yeah.
And so, there's something of that. I mean, that with the Snicket novels, I was frustrated by children's fiction that I read.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this is crap. I mean, this is awful. And I think that makes me go home and write 50 pages when I read some crummy novel. Not that I will name crummy novels I've read recently that have fueled my fire, but so that's a kind of a rage. Rage seems an overstatement for that kind of anger.
It seemed pretty interesting in light of our previous discussion. Yeah, I wanted to know what you meant by the whole rage thing.
But I don't know how one can look at the world and not feel rage, at least, over some of the basic injustices of it. And so I guess my work would be fueled by that.
Well, also, there is an element of stylization, not just in the actual prose, but also often in the structure. For example, the questions and the word lists at the end of each section of the Basic Eight, as well as the fascinating opera and 12-step program segments of Watch Your Mouth. And in this, it seemed a bit toned down, I think, adverbs in the sense that maybe because, well, you're dealing with, like, you know, minute sort of, you know, segments of the whole, but what is it about these sort of kind of ornate kind of, I guess, structures that propel, or what propels you to sort of frame your fiction within these ornate structures?
I don't really know. I just like it. When I'm planning a novel, I have all these sort of flowchart type geometrical sketches about where things go and how things will be shaped that way. And that's just the first place my mind goes. Is, yeah. Okay, I have a story. You know, how exactly will I stretch the canvas over a frame? What is the frame shape like, and how does that work? I just think that's something that's attractive to me. I just was at the end of this tour, I went to visit my sister and my brother-in-law in France, where they're staying, because my brother-in-law is getting his MBA. And I was working one day, and I left all these papers out on the dining room table. And then my brother-in-law came home with all these friends, and they all said, "Who's planning this business? What's going on here?" That was the first. And I thought, there can't be too many novelists who leave their notes out, and then a bunch of MBA students say, "Is this a startup? What's going on here?" But that's what the plan for this new novel looked like. So there's something about structure that's very attractive to me. And I often have trouble letting go of certain types of structures. When I was working on The Penultimate Peril, I was the inspiration. Part of the inspiration for that book came from Melville's The Confidence Man, mm-hmm. and I kept butting my head against the structure of A Confidence Man versus the structure of this Lemony Snicket book. And I finally went to Susan Rich, my editor, and said, "I'm really having trouble with this." And she had to explain to me very gently that it was not necessary to write a children's book based on Melville's The Confidence Man, that I could depart from that structure in order to make the story work.
Really?
Yeah. Apparently, it's not required or anything.
So, you felt you had to adhere to this structure.
Yeah, I just thought, well, it works for The Confidence Man. Why isn't it working here? And it wasn't until I was able to say, oh, look, I could just let go of that. And then the novel worked, I hope. Worked for me.
Interesting. Well, I mean, to what extent do you flowchart or diagram? It seems pretty obsessive. Has this kind of, with each particular work that you have done, has the level of obsessively sort of planning the structure become even more obsessive? Or?
Well, adverbs was something of a departure because I had this 1,000 pages that I didn't know what I was going to do with, and that was very terrifying for me, but it felt like a healthy kind of terror.
Yeah.
That, one should keep on getting terrified during the creative process in order to write a good book.
Yeah.
And certainly in writers I admire, I see that kind of complete abandonment of previous work to go on to do something different.
Sure.
And so, but yeah, I plan a lot. I don't know, it's not that I think my work is necessarily too tightly controlled, but I like to have a chart up on the wall.
Well, for the Snicket universe, I suppose that you have charts upon charts upon charts. Is there some sort of meta chart that you're sort of, that's going to be devoted to the Daniel Handler archives down the line?
Lord, I hope so. I have so many papers stored in boxes in a basement that they'd better be worth something to somebody someday.
Gotcha.
Certainly a lot of, there's a lot of charting there. I always wish that there was some kind of 3D equivalent of a legal pad. Mm. Or, I mean, I guess a legal pad is 3D, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, no,
something
I gotcha.
that could work at different angles. Because I always end up covering a piece of paper in such a way that is awkward for the sheet of paper and then starting over. All sorts of charts and quotes and and work like that.
Huh. But at the same time, though, there's a feel within your books often that there sometimes isn't a plot. Like, for example, The Basic Eight, you look at this, and the whole sort of, like, you know, the whole teachers, it kind of comes in midway through the book, and it's like the last 200 pages of that book, suddenly, like, oh, whoa, there's this major plot that just sort of surprises the reader. So it seems to me, though, that you also To what extent do you work, do you sort of like take yourself off of the chart when you write to kind of get that moment? Or are these...
Oh, a lot. Oh,
yeah, okay.
I mean, I am... Yeah, that's actually what always seems strangest to me is that I work on this very ornate structure and then I think, why use that? But it's very important to get that all in line before I go, I progress. I mean, the an overly structured novel feels somehow false. You want a novel, even a non-realistic novel, to somehow ring like life. And life has a strange pace. And I wanted The Basic Eight to feel like the journal of a teenager, which it is. And so it had to have some really boring parts, as anyone who's read The Journal of a Teenager, even ones that have been published, can attest that there's long stretches of boring. And so hopefully there's not long stretches of boring in the novel, but that there's long stretches of stasis that feel like it sure felt in high school to me, where nothing happens for a very long time.
There's also a kind of parallel culture that one finds, or like a parallel universe culture in all of your books. You have, for example, like the QED, the U2 sort of reference point. And there's also in Adverbs, the L Club, which has, Come and Get My Heart, which I almost know, it's got to be some, you know, based off of some sort of musical, you know, thing happening now. But I mean, what motivates some of these sort of like, you know, cultural parallel universe vagaries of yours? Is this
well,
kind
QED,
of
for instance, was sort of halfway between U2 and REM.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just supposed to be some big band that managed to mean something very tiny to individual listeners, but was still this huge entity. And as the L Club can sound like a boy band or like a girl band, depending on what era that kind of pop music occupies in your head. So, I mean, they're just more archetypes. In the same way that the talk show host in The Basic Eight, I hope, will refer to, you know, any thriving ideologue in televised culture, rather than referring to, say, Oprah, who she certainly resembles in the novel.
Well, part of me wondered if it was sort of like a way to kind of avoid asking, you know, bands for rights, you know, for the lyrics. Although in Adverbs, there's a flock of seagulls in there. That was
You don't really have to ask for rights. You just, I mean, there's a certain amount you can quote and not really get in trouble with.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a completely fictional slam at a band in Adverbs where I say, by a band who didn't want their music to be in here, which is not true at all. They were not contacted. But I just thought it made an interesting narrative interruption to think about whether that gets you in trouble. No, there's no... I mean, I mean, if you use pop culture too explicitly, it just means different things to different people. I mean, I think that's the trouble with a book like High Fidelity, for example, which I admire very much of. But if... over the course of that novel, if he suddenly names a song that means something different to you, that's a song that you've always found irritating, but he's finds transcendent, then you suddenly have this odd, queasy moment in the novel where you don't like it as much. And sort of the way visual art can be portrayed in film, you know, that someone will be working on a painting and you'll think, God, that's ghastly.
Yeah.
But you realize you're supposed to think it's their masterpiece in the film and it spoils it for you. And so I try to avoid explicit pop culture references, and even the Flock of Seagulls song is specific, but I mean, they would never play that in a nightclub. It doesn't actually make any sense in the scene. It was more that I didn't want so much phony pop music that begins the point of the novel. I wanted some entree point to it, but it doesn't really, I mean, that song's way too slow to dance to, actually.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too about this is that you avoid kind of dating your books, in the sense that, you know, if you were to litter your, you know, books Bret Easton Ellis style with brand names and clothing and things like that, then it would, you know, there's the risk that it would actually date. Is this kind of one of the reasons why, or is this more related to your sense of play in terms of...
I think it's just more fun to make things up. I mean, all work is dated.
Yeah.
And I don't actually think... I mean, I always think when something is called dated, that's not actually what they mean. You know, the work of Homer is dated, but you don't think, what a loser, he couldn't predict the internet. I mean, what is more frustrating in, say, the work of Bret Easton Ellis is that there's specific brand names, and you have, if you don't know the brand name, you have no idea what emotional cue that is supposed to give you. Mm-hmm. And so, in the way that Marlena Dietrich is in The Basic Eight, because I think she has a universal image that everyone can agree on, whether they like it or not. But I wouldn't put an R.E.M. song in there, because some people might find the song really beautiful, and some people might find it tepid, and some people might find it on the vanguard of artistic music, and some people might find it hopelessly corporate. I mean, it all depends on one's interpretation, and I think you don't want to have the specifics of pop culture detail do the work for you, because it won't do the work for you, is the sad truth.
So reader reaction is very much, I guess, on your mind when you write a book.
I think so. I think that's something that's happened a lot since beginning to write for children, where you're sort of forced to consider your reader because you're thinking about your own childhood and what you like to read, and also because children aren't prompted to indulge you much when they're reading. And there's a certain kind of indulging of the author that one can have as an adult reader.
Yeah.
And I don't mean hold your nose through the parts you don't like. I just mean if you've read enough books that you're able to go for a certain kind of ride and trust that the author will take you someplace interesting. And I don't think there's that kind of trust in young people at all. If it's boring, they'll put it down. And so I began to think about the audience more and more, and so I think that will continue to shape what I do.
Well, but what about being, you have a great skill of being insouciant about things like incest, you know, and about really kind of, and there's also, I mean, there's one very specific thing you did in the first two books, which I want to bring up, and I have to bring up. You have a very specific sexual thing that you're involving three fingers in both The Basic Eight.
Oh, really?
And Watch Your Mouth. It's there twice. It's there in each book. And I was like, why three fingers? It's a very specific image, you know?
You're the first to notice that, including me.
Oh.
Yeah, I never thought of myself as being insouciant, but I never found it that shocking. I mean, some of the reaction to Watch Your Mouth expressed some real shock, which had never occurred to me. I always thought we were at a point in the culture where certain kinds of things just simply aren't shocking.
Yeah.
And there's all the sex in Watch Your Mouth, for instance, is between lovers. There's no described sex between relatives. It's just sort of thought of that it might happen. And then there's really sexually explicit stuff between completely consensing, non-related people. And yet people were really shocked. That just not, it didn't occur to me. So I guess I just don't have that kind of boundary.
Huh. So in a sense, though, you this is obviously before Lemony Snicket, but do you plan on continuing, you know, this kind of, like, not being too concerned with how a particular topic is viewed or the taboo of a particular topic?
Well, I guess it's never occurred to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Now I'm getting paranoid about the sex that is in the novel that I'm working on, but I won't say anything about it because it suddenly occurred to me that maybe it's not as controversial. But, I never thought of it. I don't know. I'm just not very shocked by it.
I think it's because it's said so matter-of-factly. That's probably may affect some people's kind of, like, you know... it's so carefree the way that you...
I guess so. I don't really understand the big deal about sex, and I don't know where that came from because I wasn't raised by people who were particularly healthy about it or anything. But I never quite understand it. And every so often there's a wave of paranoia about young people picking up Watch Your Mouth because they will Google Lemony Snicket and find out that I've written books for adults, and they'll take this book home and it has sex in it.
Yeah.
And I never understand the end of that worry. What is the end of that worry?
Yeah.
You know, so they pick it up, and if they can get through all of the tortured structures of Watch Your Mouth in order to get to the sex scenes. More power to him, as far as I'm concerned.
Hey, at least the reading.
Yeah, and I don't, is the fear that then they become a rapist? I just don't understand what the fear is.
Yeah.
And yes, there are no sex scenes in the Lemony Snicket books, sort of, but I don't, I guess I just don't understand what the fear is about sex and about some people reading about sex or anything like that. And I've never, I don't, so I can, I'm always newly shocked when people are shocked about sex, and not only in my own work, but in the culture in general.
But sex is also very prominent in all of your, in the three Daniel Handler books.
Well, sex is pretty prominent. I don't know. Well, yeah, I mean, people have sex. I know. I don't know. Sex seems actually pretty omnipresent in good literature, just because that's a huge part of our lives.
I think people are sort of, if people are identifying a sort of shock value from Watch Your Mouth, it's because, again, it's the exuberant tone that it comes with. It's sort of like, yes, I'm going to go ahead and be buffing dad, you know? It's
I guess so. I find it strange when sex is consciously omitted, when there's the sort of three asterisks that happen just when one is having sex. And particularly the way it plays out in life, you don't feel like there are three asterisks and then it's the next morning and you're having brunch or something. The sex is part of the experience of that. And if you're talking about lovers or seduction or even horrific circumstances like rape, to suddenly avoid the nitty-gritty of it, when that's, of course, what would be most memorable and seized upon, seems odd to me. So I find that a weakness in some literature.
Are there any things or any subjects you would not write about, any taboos that you've had personally? Or?
Well, there are plenty of things I wouldn't write about, but I don't know if they're taboo. I mean, they're mostly just things that don't interest me. I mean, I can't... I don't think I could ever write a novel about real people. I don't think I could write one of those novels that's, I wonder what the Secretary of State under James Garfield was like. This is a novel all about his view of the Garfield administration. I don't think I could pull a novel of that off, but I don't know if that counts as a taboo.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Novels about novels, I don't like that either.
Oh, really? You don't like it, but you don't like metafiction, basically. That's actually one thing I wanted to actually ask you about.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, which is a peak of metafiction in a way.
No, but I mean, I read your review of not the last John Barth book, but the one before that, in which you kind of quibble as to where does John Barth stand in today's culture. And how much postmodernism is too much, how much of it is style, how much of it is gimmick. Maybe we could talk about that in terms of, there seems to me like, you know, what is your ratio for the perfect balance between, I guess, narrative and postmodern stylistic sort of trick?
My ratio?
Yeah, your ratio or your, how does one find the balance? What is acceptable to you? I'm just curious.
Well, I always think it's difficult to have general conversations about this kind of literature, because the fact of the matter is any statement you make that would define a novel that couldn't possibly work, you'll be able to think of an example in which it works brilliantly. And so, So I don't think that's predictable. I mean, I read, what one might call hardcore experimental fiction, and some of it is very, very good, even though it wouldn't offhand be a formula that would seem like it makes for good writing. You know, I mean, I think David Markson's novels are really beautiful and often really heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But if someone said, do you think you can write a beautiful and heartbreaking novel in which all of the paragraphs are one sentence long and many of them are quotes from other people's works or gossip about other authors? I would think, oh, that's precisely what's wrong with fiction today.
Yeah.
But it's not true. David Markson's work is really, it's really beautiful. So I get suspicious of general statements. This is my creeping literalism once more.
Yeah,
a novel should never contain, and then you think, oh, it ought to.
Well, for you, though, I guess it seems to me that you respond to books and you write books with the expectation of an emotional response. That's your first and foremost kind of criteria? Or?
I guess so. I mean, I just think that's the first thing that happens when you read a book anyway. Mm-hmm. Even so-called cerebral responses where you're really impressed by something. Yeah. That's an emotional response.
But what is like a book that would be you would possibly declare clever in the sense that, oh, well, that was a clever book, but you're still kind of grappling as to how you felt about it? That, again, I'm dealing dangerously into sort of ambiguous, highly subjective variables.
If it's clever enough that you're so impressed by it that you don't care if it doesn't break your heart.
Yeah.
I mean, P.G. Wodehouse is really, really clever. That's probably not the kind of cleverness you were thinking of.
Yeah.
And I think he's a great novelist. But I certainly understand people who don't want any part of him.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, and then on the converse, you can think of books that don't seem to have any kind of trick whatsoever and just go about breaking your heart in an ordinary way. But if you really study those novels, they're using every trick in the book.
Yeah.
I mean, I just had this fit because I was reading an essay about William Maxwell, who I really admire, and they referred to him as unadorned. And he's not unadorned at all. He uses all these tricks. He appears as the author in all these books, but you don't remember it because what you remember is love and heartbreak and these large emotional arcs that happen in his work, but actually he's a trickster.
Yeah.
It's just a kind of tricking that you don't notice until you go back and reread it and look at how he does it.
Since we're on the subject, I wanted to actually talk about Truly, the essay story in this book, which actually points specifically to references in other stories of yours. Maybe you can kind of elaborate upon this. I don't know what I typed there, but anyway, the hell with the notes.
That's right.
But this was, I suppose, a little bit different from you in the sense that it was more metafictional. Maybe what provoked the move? When did this kind of come about? Was this one of the pieces that you wrote to when you were talking about this 1,000-page document? Was this kind of like a way for you to sort of find the answer, or was this come after the fact?
Well, a lot of the 1,000-page document was sort of non-fictional. For a while, I thought this novel was really a long essay with fictional examples, the way you find what I suspect are fictional examples in self-help books or money management books, where someone says, let's pretend John and Mary have $60,000 in savings, and they work this job, and they work this job, and they earn this much amount of money, and you think, funny how that works far too neatly into the equation that you're discussing in chapter 6. And so I thought it was that kind of book. It was about love, and then it used transparently manipulated examples to make some obscure philosophical point, which arguably is still what the book is. But no, Truly just came about when I was reading the novels I was discussing earlier, both in the Dale Peck novel and the Milan Kundera novel. There is a point where the structure is made explicit. And so I thought it made sense to say, here's what this novel is and here's where it's going, just because the structure is so odd.
One thing we didn't actually talk about was when the adverbs actually figured into this equation. I mean, were the adverbs always the name of the stories in the 1,000-page document? Or?
I started typing the stories into my computer. All these different, I mean, they weren't stories is not even the right word for them, but all the different sections of the book. And because a lot of them seemed like different versions of the same story, I needed to save them under some title, frankly. Uh-huh. And if I said the story in the taxi, it wasn't specific enough. And if I said the story with the guy falling in love with two girls at once, that wasn't specific enough either. And so, but I just began to, I used adverbs in a few of them when I was saving them, and I thought, oh, that kind of works. And then I began to think about adverbs and what adverbs were, and it was a whole way in to the 1,000 pages. So that's when it started. I mean, it started as just sort of earmarks. And there's so many novelists I know who end up working that way, that something that was the temporary title became the permanent title. Something that became the fake ending that they would never use became the ending that made the most sense. And that's how it began. There were just a couple of saved documents that were adverbs, just for convenience sake. And then I realized, actually, the reason why they're so convenient is because it makes sense in what I'm doing.
Now, four of these stories were actually performed theatrically.
Yes.
Maybe you could talk about how that came to be. Did they approach you? Did you approach them?
They approached me. It's a great troupe, word for word. They perform works by writers, literally with every word in them, and they asked if I had something for them, and the novel had just been finished and was going into galleys, and I said, sure, here it is. And they chose four sections, and they put them up on stage. There's not really much to say. I mean, they're a great troupe, and they do really interesting interpretations of prose works, but I wasn't involved at all. I just got to go to the opening and
see what they did.
I actually went to the dress rehearsal because I was afraid that I didn't want to be at the opening night and see it for the first time because everyone would be staring at me wondering how I was processing it, so I didn't want it to be new.
Gotcha. Oh yeah, actually, we didn't even talk about the volcano.
Okay.
And there's a 1997 movie starring Tommy Lee Jones that has a very similar kind of plot line involving a volcano in Los Angeles. Was this an inspiration for you? Or?
There were two volcano movies that
weren't there? There was Dante's Peak and there was Volcano, but Volcano was the one that had the volcano in downtown L.A.
And Dante's Peak had Pierce Brosnan in it?
Yeah, you got it.
I saw them both. But don't have a very clear memory of them at all.
What? Because it's very close to the volcano underneath San Francisco. It's it's just different locale. I don't know if the movie influenced you or inspired you, but I mean, maybe you can talk. If it did, maybe you can talk about.
No, I don't remember those movies at all. But I remember seeing them. That was a time when I saw everything, though. Mm-hmm. No, I just thought a volcano would be interesting. I got interested in the way that a disaster shapes one's experiences, just because a romantic disaster is often spoken of in such melodramatic terms that it pales next to an actual disaster, and yet probably when you've cried hardest in your life has been over some trifle of the heart and not over one of the grand problems of the world, and that's interesting too.
Yeah.
And then when I was a kid, I'm sure I read the map wrong, but it was possible that the map was wrong. But there was I saw a map of the Ring of Fire, which is this ring around the Pacific of volcanoes, and it looked like San Francisco was under a volcano. And I began to have this long fantasy about how an earthquake could affect a volcano. I mean, you wouldn't want to have an inactive volcano prone to earthquakes. That seemed like a disastrous place to have a city. And in a lot of ways, post 9/11, to think about the way disaster can strike and how people act in disaster and how that shapes what we do.
Well, it's also a bit of a kind of, natural malapropism in the sense that you have people worrying about volcanoes instead of earthquakes. It goes back to this parallel universe idea.
Well, and San Francisco's relationship with earthquakes is so peculiar because earthquakes are hitting all the time, and yet they're never very exciting. And we're always told that there's this huge one that could come any minute and destroy the city, but it's not really clear what we could do about it.
Yeah.
I mean, even currently, there's this public awareness campaign that tells you to have all this water in the basement, and then also tells you that there's going to be a gas leak, and so you have to leave at any moment. So why keep water in your basement? It doesn't make any sense. Not to mention, you might not be home when it strikes. Then the whole thing is useless. And I felt there was a bit of that after 9/11 as well, that San Francisco had this strange sense of civic pride in which we wanted to be important enough to be targeted by a terrorist organization, except, of course, no one really wants that. But there was a sense of, it could happen to the Golden Gate Bridge, it would almost prove that we were as cool as New York if it happened. Then, of course, you don't really want it to happen, but it's unease about disaster seems a direct parallel with love. You want to go out and find someone, even though your chances are they'll stomp on your heart.
Well, you also have the opportunist, Eddie, who's videotaping from across in Marin in adverse.
Yeah, I was in Marin a few days after 9/11, and there were people in the Marin Headlands with cameras spending all day.
Really?
Yeah, thinking that they might get the footage of the Golden Gate Bridge going down.
Wow, a case of reality, truth, stranger than fiction.
Yeah, it was just felt like such a strange way to spend your day.
That's so bizarre.
I mean, it was, and I didn't, talk to them because I was afraid of them, but I began to think, well, how would you kill time? And so I thought, well, you'd have sex.
Yeah. Did this particular person you encountered actually encroach upon where you were staying like that, or?
No, I was just taking a hike. I mean, what was just odd was that it was really in the days right afterward where there was such anxiety, and it felt so good to do something like take a hike and be out in nature, and also, I confess, to be out of the large part of the city. It felt yeah. There was a certain palpable relief, yeah. And then to find that other people were also spending time in the same part of the world, yeah. But in a completely different mindset of maybe I'll get some money. And particularly because I don't know how much money it is, but it can't really be a whole lot. I mean,
like a couple hundred dollars, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Like, woohoo, I stood there all day and I got $500 and I'll always be the opportunist. You know, they can't take that away from me. It just seemed a strange fantasy. So it was very striking.
I wanted to actually ask one last question since we are expiring out of time here. About the Lemony Snicket movie and how you wrote 8 drafts. And, and I want to go ahead and set the record straight because Wikipedia can't decide whether you actually gave up on the project or you were kicked off of the project. What happened with this?
It's a long story that's really not that interesting is the truth of the matter. But I had written the 8th draft and then the producer quit and the director was fired, and so there were new producers, and and I said, I don't think I can do another draft of this script, which I thought was sort of my way of saying, look, it's good to go. And they said, that's funny, we didn't think you could do another script either, we had this other guy in mind. But it was, in fact, for the best because he had to write some godly number of drafts. And so, it was enough. So that's why Wikipedia can't decide, is because I guess officially I was sort of fired, but also I was done. Huh.
Well, it's also very rare that they actually gave you a shot because normally the writer is the person who's, the novelist is going to be the person who's going to be Shanghai.
It's not so rare that you get a shot, but it's very rare that they keep you around past the first draft. That in general, it's sort of, you turn in your first artistic draft and then they fire you. And I had this very long first artistic draft and I wasn't fired, which is something of a miracle. So, I was shocked that I'd been allowed to sit around that long. And I was pretty happy to get off it. Because it's hard work, and ultimately, I think someone who works for the most part alone just isn't a very good collaborator.
Yeah.
So they might be a good writer, but they're not good at the part where you sit around in a room with a whole bunch of people, and they're all talking about money and actors, and there's a whole lot of grabbing of a story that should take place, I think, actually. Because many of the most satisfying films, I think, are actually sort of pieces of Hollywood product. They're not some auteur's vision, but are actually sort of committee pieces like Casablanca, you know, which is utter cookie cutter. Let's have everything work at the same time and somehow is miraculous anyway. So it made sense. But it's not a very good story.
Well, how many meetings were you subject to? Were you able to do this much up here in San Francisco, or did you have to go to L.A. fairly frequently?
I was in New York most of the time that I was working on it, actually. And I mean, I couldn't tell you how many meetings. I mean, I was there. The longest stretch I was there, I think, was 6 weeks, and I was meeting every day.
Wow.
But
what goes on at these meetings? I've always wanted to know.
You just sort of talk about how the movie should go, and then you go back and you write a draft and turn it in, and then you get back in the room and you talk about how the movie should go. And I mean, when you're working with good people, when I was working with the producer who quit, it was pretty fun. I mean, it was exhausting, but it felt like good work because you were forced to examine what you liked about films. And I think that's always a valuable part of becoming a fiction writer, is learning to go back and reread William Maxwell, whoever you love, to see how they do it. And so it was really great to be in a room and say, but the part in Vertigo where you learn this, and they would say, but yeah, but in that scene, that's what happens, and that's what's missing from this scene. And you would say, oh, gosh, you're right. And then every so often you would have to say something like, but Hook is a bad movie. So it's a strange experience, but worthwhile. And they you know, they pay you.
Yeah, that's of course.
So.
Well, I guess though it seems interesting to me because it's like it's very strangely there are parallels to an MFA workshop in the way that you're discussing films as you're writing this.
I guess so. I don't have an MFA.
I know. But I mean, the whole sort of even like any kind of workshop sort of piece where you sit around, and you have to justify the story, and you have to compare it to other books and other short stories. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what good it does literature. Although there's certainly plenty of good books written by people who have their MFAs. But I mean, I think a book is basically one person's gig, and so I don't know how many conversations you need with other people to make it good. But a film is most certainly the work of lots and lots of people, and so you do need lots of people in the room making decisions.
Okay. Well, Daniel, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm sitting here in the boring room. It's just another rainy Sunday afternoon. I'm wasting my time, I got nothing to do. I'm hanging around, I'm waiting for you. But nothing ever happens, and I wonder. I'm driving around in my car. I'm driving too fast, I'm driving too far. I'd like to change my point of view. I feel so lonely, I'm waiting for you. But nothing ever happens, and I wonder. I wonder how, I wonder why. Yesterday you told me about the blue, blue sky. And all that I can see is just a yellow lemon tree.